You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. I'm happy to welcome Glenn Frankel back to the show. Glenn Frankel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist whose last book was about the John Ford film classic The Searchers. And now Glenn Frankel tells the story of another classic Western in High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Glenn Frankel, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
So in your book on The Searchers, you told the story of the actual event that gave birth to the story, and then you discussed the novel and the novelist who created it, and then you discussed the making of the film and the aftermath and its place in the pantheon of American film. So what layers of the onion did you find in the story of High Noon?
Well, here it wasn't a question of trying to roam across, you know, a century and a half of American history, which was a foolish odyssey, though in the end I learned a lot and enjoyed doing it. This time I thought it would be a lot easier because the two strands I was looking at, the making of this classic Western and the rise of the Hollywood blacklist, they were happening simultaneously. And I thought that, you know, it would be an easier lift to toggle back and forth between each. As it happens, the Hollywood blacklist is an enormously large and complex subject and required a lot of time and effort just to get grounded in a way that allowed me to go forward and think about actually writing something down about it. So the time frame in the end, the amount of time expended in the end was just as much. But here, too, I felt I'd hit a rich vein of American history at the same time I was looking at the movie. And I hope that, you know, each sort of illuminates the other, that if you, the movie tells you a little more about the blacklist era, and the blacklist era is the context for the movie.
And what a great movie. I mean, I happen to love High Noon. I've always loved it. It's funny because some of the greatest Westerns are the films that film critics always tell you they're not a real Western. You know, they tell you Stagecoach is not a real Western or High Noon. And yet, to me, they kind of seem like Westerns.
Yeah, well, that's been one of the raps against High Noon from the beginning, that it was a social drama sort of dressed up, kitted up as a Western. Well, you know, I mean, yes and no. Certainly the screenwriter Carl Foreman had the blacklist in mind when he wrote Stagecoach, especially in the last part of the script when he was under subpoena to testify at the House Un-American Activities Committee. But at the same time, I mean, you know, he sets it in a small Western town. It has a lot of the tropes and themes of the lawman, you know, confronting evil. And, you know, I hasten to add, it has Gary Cooper, one of the real authentic movie Western heroes of all time. So that gives it the authenticity I think it needs to survive that particular challenge.
You know, Gary Cooper, and of course, after I read your book, I've seen High Noon dozens of times, but after I read your book, I sat down and watched it again. And Gary Cooper just had a great deal of affection for him, and as an actor, I think he's one of the best.
I was going to say, he's an interesting guy because, you know, he's not over-emoting at any point. I mean, yeah, he himself didn't always think he was an actor. He comes to Hollywood. He's like 23 years old. He simply comes out to visit his parents who have moved there from Montana. He thinks he's staying for Thanksgiving. He never leaves. And in a couple of years, he's a star. He's, you know, his name's over the title of every film he's in. But he comes on at the end of the silent era and the beginning of the talkies, and he learns right from the start that there's no point in over-emoting, that you're basically playing to the front row, if you will, in every movie because of the close-ups, because of the way they look at you. And so he learns that a little is enough. A little is more than enough, and you never see him hamming it up. And in High Noon especially, I mean, the restraint with which he performs, the poignancy of his dilemma, the vulnerability that he expresses just, you know, with a little shifting of the eyes or with the way he carries himself as he walks alone down that dusty Western street. This is all great movie performance.
I'm not trying to be a hero. If you think I like this, you're crazy.
Exactly. I mean, he can't really articulate, you know, his thought process here. He's a proud man. He also says at one point to his wife, you know, they're making me run. I've never run before. So there's pride, but there's also this extreme sense of vulnerability. He clearly doesn't want to be a martyr. he addresses those words to his new bride. He's just gotten married that same morning, a Sunday morning, and then gotten word that, you know, his arch enemy is coming back to town with three hired gunmen to kill him. He doesn't want to die. He doesn't want to be a martyr. He'd really like to ride off with his beautiful bride. I mean, who wouldn't want to ride off with Grace Kelly? But he can't. He really has to stay there and face what's going to happen. He thinks he's going to get support from his friends, and he really tries hard to line up the entire town to go out there with him. And yet, when they won't, he doesn't turn tail and run. He just faces up to the fact that he might die this day.
And how does that represent the Blacklist?
Well, as I suggested earlier, Carl Foreman is the screenwriter of High Noon. He's a former member of the Communist Party, and by 1951, when the House Un-American Activities Committee comes back to Hollywood for a second go-round of hearings, public hearings, Carl knows he's going to be called to testify. His profile has risen over time. He's been nominated twice for Oscars for Best Screenplay, and High Noon will be his third. So suddenly he becomes a target, and by June he gets a subpoena informing him, calling him for September, so he knows what's coming. He's putting the finishing touches on the script, but what's beginning to leach into the script are things that people say are the situation that he finds himself. He begins to imagine himself as the lawman, and the House Un-American Activities Committee is the bad guys coming after him, coming to get him, and he can't help but notice that his friends and his business partners in Hollywood are not backing him up. In fact, they're kind of moving away from him. In fact, they really would like him to cooperate with this committee because they're afraid if he doesn't cooperate, they're going to be the next ones being called to testify. So as Carl himself put it, he starts feeling that he's become the lawman and the lawman's become him. And High Noon begins to become something of a Blacklist parable.
Well, there's another famous Blacklist parable, which is On the Waterfront, directed by Ilya Kazan, who was a guy who did cooperate with HUAC, and the hero of On the Waterfront is a guy who informs on the mob to the police. Are they two different sides of the same coin there?
Well, yes, I think they are in a special kind of way. Because, you know, these are both fabulous movies, and when you see Waterfront today or you see High Noon, I don't know how you feel about it, Gary, but I don't see separate, you know, opposing films. I think they both end up transcending the politics a bit to be about courage and about an individual who stands up against moral corruption in the community he's in. Again, an individual doesn't really want to do that. Marlon Brando's former boxer, you know, doesn't want to defy his pals and the corrupt trade union that's running, you know, Hoboken. But in the end, he feels he can't live with himself unless he does it. So both films, in a way, I think are about moral courage in the face of evil. And I think they're both fabulous films, and they illustrate the different ways that artists, the people who made these films, you know, went about their work and came to their conclusions.
Well, Glenn Frankel, talk a little bit, if you will, about the dilemma of the House Un-American Activities Committee, what they were asking people to do.
Well, you know, they first come out in 1947 for their first set of hearings on communist infiltration of the movie business, such as it was. And that's when the Hollywood Ten, these ten screenwriters and others, defy the committee, refuse to cooperate, and they end up going to prison. So by the time they come back, the committee comes back in 1951, I guess you could say, for a sequel, right? I mean, Hollywood's a great place to hold public hearings because you can call movie stars to testify. And everybody knows the game at this point. Everybody knows that it's, and Carl knows, it's not going to be enough just to tell the committee, yeah, I was once in the Communist Party, as he was, between the late 1930s and the early 40s. I'm sorry, it was a mistake. I regret doing it. That wasn't going to be sufficient, that the thing he was going to be held to was to name other people, to accuse other folks of being subversives. And some of these people were his friends or his former friends, his former comrades, if you will, and that was the price to keep your job. So he goes into this knowing very well that if he doesn't give them what they want, he's going to get blacklisted. And that's the terrible dilemma that he faces as, you know, as the calendar moves on and High Noon's being filmed at the very same time that he's going to be called to testify.
Well, was Carl Foreman a communist? Did he advocate the overthrow of democratic society?
Well, that's two different questions. Yes, he joined the American Communist Party in the late 30s, like a lot of folks did. He's an anti-fascist. He believes in civil rights. He sees the party as sort of the purest manifestation of some of those things, idealistic. He shared the ideals. Remember, this is during the Great Depression, when the entire system of capitalism is sputtering, and democratic socialism is certainly something that a lot of people turn to, or social democracy, you might call it. But by the early 40s, Carl's disillusioned with the party. There's been the Hitler-Stalin Pact. Other things have happened. And he leaves. This is the same thing that happened to a lot of idealistic folks out in Hollywood, especially among screenwriters and some others, who joined the party, great hopes, and basically left. But that isn't going to help him once the committee comes out. The committee isn't interested in you know, his bona fides. And the fact is that most of the people who joined the Communist Party, Gary, were not looking to violently overthrow the government. They thought of themselves as Democrats with a small D. They wanted social change, no question about that. But they wanted it by the ballot box. They wanted it by community organizing. They felt that they were good Americans. They were following Jeffersonian principles. The party, you know, swung back and forth between being very secretive and, you know, and answering to the dictates of Moscow, to parts of the party which were very different than that, and were very much looking for social democracy. So, but there was no question, of overthrowing the government. There was a question of organizing. These were political dissidents. They weren't traitors.
And these traitors, I mean, these dissidents, sorry. These guys did write movies, you know, like I remember seeing The Boy with the Green Hair. With, you know that movie, The Boy with the Green Hair?
Yes, Joseph Losey directed it.
Yeah, and it was, who was later blacklisted, and it was written by Ben Barsman and Alfred Lewis Levitt. Those guys were both blacklisted. And that's a movie that definitely has, you know, I mean, it's trying to make us all peaceful and nice.
Well, there's a leftist critique in a number of movies, you know, especially after World War II, and you know, when the boys come back from the war, Hollywood's kind of struggling as to what kind of entertainment to give them, because these guys have changed and the industry is changing. And you see a number of movies at that point that are socially vigorous, All the Kingsmen, for example, and you know, The Best Years of Our Lives and Gentlemen's Agreement. They have, I guess you could say, a leftist critique of what's going on in America, but, you know, I mean, everybody's entitled to their opinion. There weren't a lot of these movies. These were the ones I've named are some of the very best of them. They were done by a relatively small group of people who were trying to, yeah, have something to say.
Two of those films won Best Picture of the Year Oscars.
Yeah, they were wonderful films, actually, and they are the height of, and you know, my guys, Carl Foreman and his partner, Stanley Kramer, who was a young film producer who founded his own company, they were making movies in this period that were socially meaningful, starting with Champion, a boxing movie with Kirk Douglas that did very well. And you could see it as a critique of the brutal side of capitalism. The Men, with Marlon Brando in his first role, playing a paraplegic war veteran. Home of the Brave, about racism during World War II. These were very interesting movies, black and white, low budget, and yet they had a point to make. But they were very American. You know, there was no subversion lurking in their souls. There was an effort at reform, at improvement. They were very idealistic films.
I was talking here on the show with Lee Grant, who was an actress who was blacklisted for 11 years, and she was one of those people who had worked with Ilya Kazan, and like many other Hollywood people, found it very difficult to forgive him. I asked her if she ever did forgive him, and she said, she told me a funny story, she said yes, that she ran into him someplace, and She smiled at him because he looked familiar, and she said hello, and they started talking. Then she remembered who he was and why she was supposed to be mad at him. But by that time, it was too late because she'd already been friendly to him.
Well, one of the interesting things I found, Gary, as I was looking into the blacklist is that, you know, the really deep wounds weren't between political enemies. I mean, you knew the committee was out to get you, right? I mean, there was no two ways about it. So you could be angry. You could think they were, terrible. But you didn't expect any different. The really deep wounds were between business partners and collaborators and even family members and people who were once your allies, who once held the same beliefs you did, because that was betrayal. When they let you down, when they named names as Kazan did or did other things, that was a deep wound. And for Kazan, of course, it never really healed. Even when he gets the honorary Oscar, 50 years later, a lot of people are picketing outside, some of them his former colleagues.
And a lot of them sat on their hands and didn't applaud when he got his award.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this was a deep wound. My own feeling, looking back on it and researching it, it's very hard to put yourself in the shoes of these folks and decide what you would do in a similar situation if you were facing the loss of your career versus selling out your friends. I mean, there's no good answer here. And a lot of people were faced with this terrible dilemma.
Well, Kazan in his book said words to the effect that why should he give up his career to protect a lot of people that he didn't like?
Yeah, well, he had left the party in the late 30s, and he felt strongly that the party was a difficult dissident group that he didn't agree with at all. But he also understood, I think, at the same time that he was being bullied by the committee, which he also didn't have any kind words for, that he was put in an impossible situation. And Elia Kazan being Kazan, he took it on by the, full frontal and put a, ran an ad in the New York Times after he named names explaining why he did it and said he was proud of it.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're chatting tonight with Glenn Frankel. His new book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Well, we talked about Gary Cooper, the actor, but Gary Cooper, the man, really emerges as a hero in your story. I mean, he was a guy who was a friendly witness to the HUAC, but of course he didn't have anything to tell them because he had never been a member of the Communist Party. But he really does, stand up for Carl Foreman.
Well, you're right. First off, Cooper is a conservative Republican. He's a charter member of the Motion Picture Alliance for the Preservation of American Ideals, which John Wayne was also a charter member of. And this is an anti-communist group founded in the mid-40s. So Cooper's politics were very clear. But he liked working with Carl Foreman on this movie. He really liked the script for High Noon. And Cooper, at this point in his career, is desperate for good scripts. So he gets together with him. He enjoys the process. He trusts Carl. He believes in him. And so when Carl comes to him and says, hey, look, I've gotten a subpoena. I'm going to have to testify. I was once in the Communist Party. I'm not in it anymore. But I understand if you want to walk away from this, given your own beliefs. Cooper says, no, I know who you are, and I trust you, and I'll go along with you. It's an intuitive decision, not an ideological one. And even after Carl refuses to cooperate with the committee, and he's more or less blacklisted, and he loses his job with the Stanley Kramer Company, Cooper says he'll work with him and will cooperate in forming, in backing Carl in forming another independent little film company. And please, use my name. And Carl does that, and everything works fine for about 8 days. But the pressure on Cooper from his old buddies, from people like John Wayne, who's a strong anti-communist, from the gossip columnists Hedda Hopper and Luella Parsons, and from his own studio at Warner Brothers, the pressure's so great that after 8 days, he has to publicly withdraw.
It's a sad story, but Cooper still comes off okay.
He tries. He's one of the few who really tried, who stuck his neck out. It's an indicator of how impossible it was for individuals to stand up to this thing. There was no way Carl could still work in Hollywood and start his own company after refusing to cooperate with the committee. and nobody was standing up. I mean, you know, all of our democratic institutions, I think, let us down during the blacklist, and the Hollywood studios and the liberal community did as well.
You know, I can remember when, I think it's Michael Wilson, who won an Emmy Award for writing sometime in the early 60s, and used the term blacklist, you know, for like the first time in public. He said, "It's great to get this award because I've been blacklisted for so long." And people were shocked.
Michael Wilson was a very special case. He had won an Academy Award for A Place in the Sun in the early 50s. He was blacklisted for at least a decade. And he and Carl were the co-writers on The Bridge on the River Kwai, a movie that won the Academy Award for Best Screenplay in 1958. The only problem is that Wilson's name and Forman's name were not on it. And they weren't recognized by the Motion Picture Academy as the actual authors of the movie until 26 years later in 1984, when they were given Academy Awards. The only problem was that the people who came to pick up the awards for them were their widows, because both of them were dead.
Well, that's awful.
It's a sad moment, and, you know, that's why I say the damage, the personal damage, was so intense. It broke up friendships. It certainly ended Carl and Stanley Kramer's longtime collaboration. And, you know, and the pain of that, I don't think, ever went away.
Well, Stanley Kramer, you know, he went on to make a lot of, you know, socially relevant films like Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and Judgment at Nuremberg and things like that. Well, how come he couldn't bring himself to support Carl Forman?
Well, at first he tried. He really did. He supported him privately. He said, you know, we'll find a way around this, you know. But as the time came closer for Carl to testify, first of all, the Kramer Company had just signed a new deal with Columbia Pictures. So rather than making one movie a year and some profits, they were about to make six movies a year for 5 years and make big money on all those movies. And they didn't want anything to mess up that deal. So as the time gets closer for Carl to testify, Kramer and his other partners are pressuring Carl to cooperate with the committee. They just are afraid that the deal is going to be destroyed and that their careers are going to be destroyed as well. Now, Carl, you're absolutely right. Kramer goes on. The Columbia deal wasn't such a great artistic success or financial success after all, but after a while, Stanley gets into the business of directing as well as producing movies, and he makes some great ones, starting with the Defiant ones. He hires some blacklisted writers to work with him, and he even debates the head of the American Legion, the anti-communist organization, on national television in 1960. So he does deserve credit for helping kill the blacklist later on. But the friendship with Carl is never restored. Carl's widow, Eve, described for me a scene where Carl, many years later, when he's back in Hollywood, gets on an elevator at Columbia Pictures, and there's Stanley on the same elevator. And the two men don't look at each other. They don't say a word. They simply look forward. The point is, after 1951, these two guys, these old friends, never spoke to each other again.
Isn't that crazy? So, I mean, they both had things to hold against each other. I mean, what did Stanley Kramer hold against Carl Forman?
Well, Stanley never talked much about it afterwards, but it's clear that he felt Carl had misled him early on about his involvement with the Communist Party. And it also, Stanley was uncomfortable with the way what Carl was planning to do. He felt that there was a little threat in Carl's remarks that perhaps, you know, if he was going to start naming names, he might name Stanley's name as well, even though Stanley was never in the party. You know, I can't really sort through what was said in their private meetings to know for sure. I give you some of their claims in the book, but there were only two men in the room. But Stanley was angry at Carl for not cooperating, but at the same time, I think he understood. He said he did. And in future years, in his own memoirs and in other places, he never, ever attacked Carl. He simply expressed his deep regrets that their partnership had fallen apart. I think that was his way of acknowledging that, you know, he wasn't comfortable with what he had done in this situation.
There has been, over the years, a lot of debate and argument and claims about who is responsible for the greatness of High Noon.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You know, that's a typical Hollywood thing in a way. But I think it's worse in high noon because of the political, you know, implications and overlay we've been talking about. But the fact is, High Noon was a low-budget film. It was the last on the old contract. Stanley, so Carl and the director, Fred Zinnemann, were kind of left on their own to do a lot of the production work and everything on it. Nobody expected it was going to be a big hit. And when it was, when it was a critical success and it made a lot of money that first summer, 1952, everybody started taking credit for it. The film editor, Elmo Williams, said he had cut it and he had saved High Noon because it was a flabby mess when Zinnemann turned in the director's cut. Stanley himself, who had started as a film editor, said no, he was the one who saved High Noon. He was responsible for making it so good. You know, then there was the song by Dmitri Tiomkin and Ned Washington. Tiomkin took a lot of credit for saving High Noon with this wonderful ballad that gets played during the film. So everybody's jumping in there. I found some interviews with these guys that had never been transcribed when I was looking at archives in Hollywood, at the Motion Picture Academy, at the University of Southern California, and different versions of what people said, and I was able to compare it with what's actually in the script. And I came to an amazing conclusion, Gary. You want to know what it was?
Of course.
Well, I concluded that they were all responsible for the movie, that it was a collaboration, and that, you know, Fred Zinnemann's direction, which was wonderful, and Floyd Crosby's use of camera and the documentary feel and the gritty look of the movie, and that Carl's suspenseful script and Cooper's great acting and the acting of the other folks in it, and the film editing by a guy named Elmo Williams, that all these things, and the beautiful song, that all these things had come together to make it a great movie, and that it was a true collaboration among great craftsmen.
Well, when I was watching the movie again after reading your book, and I was very conscious of the editor, what is his name again? I'm sorry, Williams?
Yes, Elmo Williams.
He was claiming that it was his idea to put in all the clocks and to keep showing the clocks. But if you watch the movie, they all look to their clocks. You know, Katie Girardeau looks to the clock. They all, you know, you can't do that in editing. You can't make the actors do something they didn't do.
Exactly. They're looking up. There's a clock in every scene, as you know, sometimes two. The clocks get bigger as the movie goes along. And the actors are looking at the clock constantly. Carl, in his original idea for the movie, wanted it to be set in real time. He wanted the marshal to get married around 10:30 on a Sunday morning and then discover immediately after that that the chief bad guy was coming to town to meet the other three gunmen, and he was coming on the noon train. So there was about 85 minutes in there for the lawman to go around town and try to drum up support and for the story to unfold, and the clocks add to the suspense. The suspense gets tauter and tauter as the movie goes on, in part because the clocks get bigger and bigger.
Now, you mentioned the song, "Oh, Don't Forsake Me, Oh My Darling." It's a great song. What movie has a song that tells the entire plot of the picture over the credits of the movie?
Well, that doesn't happen too often, does it? But it's not only, what's interesting also is it's telling it from the point of view of the lawman. "Do not forsake me, oh my darling." He's singing it to his new bride, who's very upset that he's, you know, rather than ride off with her, that he's going to stay in town and face these four bad guys. And in the movie, Cooper is, the lawman is a very sort of taciturn Western figure. He can't really explain himself except to say something like, "If you don't understand it, I really can't explain it to you." But in the song, the narrator is explaining it, how he can't leave because he has to face this desperate killer. "But what will I do if you leave me?" You know, he's pleading with her to understand his plight and to stand by him. It's something the lawman can't quite bring himself to say to her in the movie, but there it is, laid out poignantly and more than once, because, as you know, I mean, parts of that song are played and replayed 10 or even 12 times during the course of the film.
It's brilliantly used in the score, in the underscore of the film, too.
Yes, Dmitri Tiomkin used that theme, that motif, if you will, constantly in his score. I think the score is a little overblown still. You know, it's one of the few things that I think dates the movie, because otherwise I think it has a very modern feel to it. But the song itself, the ballad, and it's sung by the great cowboy singer Tex Ritter, and it, whose voice is also poignant, and it's, you know, it's softly done at times. It's you know, it's a ballad that really clings to us. And, you know, I think it speaks to what really is at the heart of the film. We were talking earlier about this question of, you know, the political meaning and the difference with On the Waterfront. I think what's really, in the end, the greatest thing about High Noon and why we're still talking about it 65 years later is that it's about courage. It's about reluctant courage in the face of evil. It's about doing what you have to do because you know you don't really have any choice. I think it speaks to people. It speaks to me, certainly, and I'm sure to you. It's something very American about that, doing the right thing because that's the only thing you can do. And the song speaks exactly to that, and it's kind of helps tie the whole thing together.
Do not forsake me, oh my darling, on this our wedding day. Do not forsake me, oh my darling, wait long. The noonday train will bring Frank Miller. If I'm a man, I must be brave, and I must face that deadly killer. Are I a coward, a craven coward? Are I a coward in my grave? Oh, to be torn twixt love and duty, supposing I lose my fair half beauty. Look at that big hand move along near in High Noon. He made a vow while in state's prison, vowed it would be my life or his, and I'm not afraid of death, but oh, what will I do if you leave me? Do not forsake me, oh my darling. You made that promise when we wed. Do not forsake me, oh my darling. Although you're grieving, I can't be leaving until I shoot Frank Miller dead. Wait long, wait long, wait long, wait long.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're chatting with Glenn Frankel. His new book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic. Well, John Wayne famously didn't like the movie, and you quote him in some interview that he gave talking about why he doesn't like it, but I don't think he's telling the truth. He had a conversation I remember hearing about with Kirk Douglas. In an interview with Kirk Douglas, he was saying that Duke was mad at him for making Lust for Life because Kirk Douglas's character cries in the movie. And John Wayne said, you know, we don't cry. Actors like us, we're not supposed to cry. And there is a scene in High Noon where Gary Cooper does seem to put his head down on his desk and cry. He doesn't quite get to tears because he's interrupted, but he seems to be crying.
Yeah, and it's this vulnerability, as I suggested earlier, that I think is part of the greatness of the performance. You know, Wayne was all over the place on this. He actually, when Cooper won Best Actor, Wayne is the one who stood on the podium and accepted the award for Cooper, who was on a location shoot. And Wayne even says in this very gracious address that, boy, he wishes he'd gotten a good part like High Noon. But, you know, that's all well and good, but the fact is he didn't like High Noon very much. He knew, you know, because Carl had refused to cooperate with the committee, Wayne decided that High Noon must be a commie film. And he's kind of smelled out a bit of the subversive nature of its soul, the way it looked at the community that had failed the lawman. And, you know, church and state had let the lawman down by not rallying to his side. Wayne called it the most un-American thing he'd ever seen. And he and the great Howard Hawks, the director, Both didn't like the way the lawman pleaded with the community to help him, pleaded with other people. They thought the lawman should be a professional. It could stand up alone to the bad guys if he had to. And they even made their own critique of High Noon. They called it Rio Bravo. It came out in 1958.
Well, of course, Coop doesn't exactly plead. You know, he's such a great actor, as you were saying. You know, he can just do so much with his eyebrow and his corner of his mouth. He doesn't actually ever ask anybody to do anything.
Well, he does, you know, he does issue a statement both in the church and in the saloon saying, these guys are coming, I'm going to need all the deputies I can get. We stood up to them before, we can do it again, and I'm calling for you to help me. I mean, there is some of that. It's all done in a sort of, you know, business-like way, matter-of-fact way, almost.
Cowboy way.
Yeah, it's the cowboy way, exactly. It's what macho men do. But as you pointed out earlier, the macho is a sort of false front for him because he's desperate. He almost leaves town. Remember, he goes out to the stable and looks at a horse longingly and is thinking seriously about saddling up and heading out on his own. But he stiffens. He doesn't do it. He'd like to get out of this. There's no way he wants to get killed that day. But in the end, he does what a man does what a man has to do. There's no macho, you know, posturing about it. But there is pride. There is a sense that this is his job and he's going to do it. And if nobody's going to be there behind him, he's going to do it anyway.
No other Western that I can think of portrays women the way High Noon does. You know, in Bud Butterker's films with Randolph Scott, there's always a woman and she's out there. She's on her own and she's beautifully made up with red lipstick and, you know, she's not too convincing. But the two women in High Noon are pretty amazing.
Well, they are. These are very strong parts for two women who are both in love with the marshal. Katia Jurado plays a Mexican woman who was his lover and is a businesswoman in town and was also the lover of the bad guy who's coming back at one point. And then Grace Kelly, of course, plays the young bride who's just married this guy and thinks they're going to go off together to another town and he's going to retire and become a storekeeper.
That's her first picture, right?
It's her first starring role. It was her second picture, but it's the first one where she has a real meaty role. So they both love him, but they're both angry in conflict with him. Katia Jurado because he's, you know, he dumped her basically a year earlier, and he's taken up with Grace Kelly. And Grace because she doesn't want him to go out there and, you know, and risk his life. But in the end, they both have to decide what to do. One of them leaves town. The bride, in the end, runs to protect the lawman, her new husband, and helps him defeat the bad guys. But, you know, these two are really strong, interesting people. They're not the kind of women you normally see, you know, in American Westerns. I think it's very satisfying in the end that the woman sacrifices her own principles in order to help save her husband's life. And I think it knits the marriage together. You know, there's a terrible rift in it at the beginning of the movie, but they come back together at the end. And they reject the town and its sort of corrupt values, and they ride off together like any good Western.
I'm waiting for High Noon 2 to see what... No, never mind.
No, they've tried that.
Did they?
I think there was even briefly a television show starring the great David Soul, remember, from Starsky and Hutch?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think they made about 10 of those, maybe less. It bombed. Gary, I'm sorry to tell you, but Gary Cooper's dead, and without him, there's no High Noon.
He died young, too. I mean, it didn't seem like he was young, but he was only 60 years old at the time of his death.
He barely made it to 60. I mean, those were the days when these guys smoked two or three packs of cigarettes a day, and it got all of them. By the time Cooper was dead, Clark Gable had died, you know, at an age of less than 60. Humphrey Bogart had died. Jerome Power, all these guys... passed away early and sadly.
Yes, Stanley Kramer's favorite actor, Spencer Tracy, lived all the way to age 67 or something like that. He died young, too.
He barely made it through Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. It's just the way things were. We can all count ourselves fortunate that we live in an age where cigarettes are not considered healthy and where we all have plenty of examples to warn us off. But poor Cooper, you know, he could have had another 10 or 15 wonderful years as an actor, and it's just sad that he went so early.
There are some really good supporting performers in the picture, in addition to the women that we mentioned. Crichton Cheney, or Lon Chaney Jr., as he was known. He does a great job as the old sheriff, but you pointed out that he's actually younger than Gary Cooper, or...
Yes, he's supposed to be Cooper's mentor and a generation older, but he's actually 5 years younger than Cooper. But there are so many great supporting actors, not just the two women, but Thomas Mitchell, who plays the town councilor who betrays Cooper. The three bad guys are fabulous, who are waiting for the train for their, you know, for the big boss. Lee Van Cleef, the great Lee Van Cleef, yeah. This is his first movie. He doesn't even have a line in the movie, but he looks like Lee Van Cleef, and he looks terrific. Robert Wilkie, who's little known these days, but he was in a lot of Westerns as the bad guy. He's in The Magnificent Seven, even, at one point, as one of the sort of foolishly challenges James Coburn to a duel and ends up with a knife in his gut. The acting was fabulous up and down the line, and it's the craftsmanship of the people who made the movie, the actors, you know, the set designers, the film editors, because even though Elma Williams didn't save the movie, he did a terrific job of cutting it. You know, all of these people really contributed to make it a great film.
I'm always looking at my watch these days when I go to the movies because, you know, the movies are so long. With this movie, they're looking at their clocks, and the movie just whizzes by. It's a very compact and brilliantly
made.
Yes,
it is. You know, I didn't always love High Noon. I always thought it was good, but I didn't have it up there in my top 10 list, let's say, of Westerns. But I've seen it several times. You know, I've seen it a lot over the last year and a half, as you can imagine. And every time I see it, I see a little more. I see something special in it. And I'm really spending a lot of time now looking at Cooper's performance every time I see it, because it really is a magical thing that he does. And, you know, I just think it gets better and better with viewing.
Well, you know, he was a silent movie actor, as you pointed out, but he was different than the silent movie actors of his day. I was real familiar with Wings and the scene that he has in that picture, which is great. But I just recently saw this Blu-ray of Children of Divorce, a film that I had never even heard of before, in which he co-stars with Clara Bow. And it's not a particularly great movie. It's kind of like a soap opera. But his performance is really unique in silent films. He's not a pantomimist the way, you know, John Gilbert was or somebody like that.
No, he's the ultimate natural, I would say. You know, he's got no training whatsoever, but he's tall and beautiful, and boy, what a great-looking guy, you know, when he was young. You know, just striking. And he has restraint from the beginning. You know, he's born and raised in Montana. He's an authentic cowboy, really, even though both his parents come from England originally. And he just has that kind of taciturn, reticent, you know, charm. He can charm you to death. And as his career goes on, he does a lot of non-Westerns, non-adventure stories where he plays the sort of insouciant hero. But he's always good. He develops a pretty good range. He does some great movies with the great director Frank Capra, where he plays a sort of populist figure. He's just got that glint in his eye, and Wings was his breakthrough in many ways. He's on the screen, what, for about 80 seconds?
Yeah.
And yet he steals the scene and virtually steals the movie as a doomed airman about to go out to his death.
Eating a Hershey bar.
He just has presence, and that's the way Cooper played it for his whole career.
Well, Glenn Frankel, now you've done these two books, now you've found yourself a niche. What movie are you going to tell us everything about next?
Well, I'm still considering it. These first two sort of fell into my lap in various ways. I've given a little thought, believe it or not, to Midnight Cowboy, another thing that I think of as a Western in its own way,
yeah.
And a very different one, of course. So I'm considering that. I'm looking for others. I've really enjoyed this marriage of a great movie and a great turbulent moment in American history. I think each, as I said earlier, illuminate the other, and I've enjoyed sort of going back and forth between them. So that's, I think I got at least one more in me, Gary, and let's see what it is.
I'm walking here.
Exactly.
Well, this book is fantastic. It's called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist and the Making of an American Classic, and is written by my guest, the brilliant Glenn Frankel. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, listen, Gary, thanks a lot. As always, a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Glenn Frankel. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. His new book is called High Noon, The Hollywood Blacklist, and The Making of an American Classic. And his previous book that you'll also love is called The Searchers. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. We'll see you next time.